So that switch happens in September, next week here on Fresh Air. It's a minute after 4, and this is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. There's hardly a person who doesn't think of themselves as having strong feelings about communism, but 10 people would probably give you 10 different answers if you asked what the principles of communism are, and there are enormous ideological and practical differences in the way communism is practiced in different countries. In a moment, we're going to hear from Gus Hall, the head of the American Communist Party. Then in a half hour, my guest will be historian Philip Foner, who's going to compare and contrast the American Communist Party with Eurocommunism and Soviet communism. And we're going to discuss the influence that the American Communist Party has had on American politics and the labor movement. Gus Hall was born 70 years ago in Iron, Minnesota. He worked as a logger, a miner, a steel worker, helped lead the 1937 Ohio Little Steel Strike, and was one of the founders of the United Steelworkers of America. He spent a good deal of the McCarthy era in prison, serving an 8-year sentence under the now illegal Smith Act, on charges of conspiring to teach the overthrow of the U.S. government. He's been the American Communist Party's general secretary since 1959, and he's run on their ticket for president every 4 years since 1972. There are now approximately 20,000 party members in the United States. The American Communist Party is regarded by many is regarded hostily by many Americans, and it has alienated many members, many people in the American left. It seems that a lot of people don't take the party seriously as a political force, and that's one of the things that I spoke with Gus Hall about. But the first thing I wanted to know is what experiences radicalized him.
Well, of course, I was born into a rather radical family. My parents both came through the radical movement, Socialist Party, and then into the Communist Party. And besides that, I was born into a community mainly consisting of ex-miners who were blacklisted because they tried to organize the union in the iron mines in northern Minnesota. And so it was a radical community. But I would say, you know, that family relationship, of course, do influence one, but experience is the fundamental thing. And I've always said that the big lumber corporations and the big wheat farmers of North Dakota and Minnesota are, in a sense, responsible for my radicalism. And that is that when you work in the lumber camps from, daylight to dark with $1 a day, and that's enough to radicalize anybody. And the same thing in the grain fields of the North Dakota and South Dakota. You had to work all day long for a dollar a day again. And that I think, kind of gives one an underpinning of understanding of the exploitation of the system and so on. And so I think those two factors are responsible for changing my mind and becoming militant and going into the trade union movement. I started unions when I was a teenager, actually, in lumber camps. And then into the communist movement very early in life.
Yeah, why did you join the communist movement? Because a lot of people went through that radicalizing process as you did and were militant within trade unions but didn't make that step to joining the party.
Well, I think the basic difference is that I was convinced that at some point socialism will replace capitalism and that it's inevitable. And I think life is proving me correct that it is an inevitable process. And I think that was the fundamental difference. See, not only that, but I was a full-time trade union organizer years later, including I'm a founding member, one of the 12 founding members of the United Steelworkers of America, and organized that. And I worked full-time for the union during the 36, 37 period. And I made another decision then, and that is that I resigned as a international representative of the United Steelworkers. And I said then that I'm resigning that lucrative, really a lucrative job, unlimited expense accounts and so on, and that I was returning back to become a functionary of the Communist Party in the steel area in Youngstown. And when I wrote the letter to Phil Murray, who was the head of the steelworkers at that time, I said that I just feel that I can make a bigger contribution, including for the union movement and for the steelworkers, by organizing a communist movement and working with the unions in that sense.
What was it like for you during the McCarthy period?
Well, of course, I served an 8-year prison sentence in Leavenworth Penitentiary for my thoughts. And interesting enough, especially for young people, that it's the only case of its kind in the United States history. And that is that we were, under the Smith Act, convicted for thinking, because the exact charge or indictment and conviction stated, you know, that it was a conspiracy to teach the duty and the necessity of overthrowing the government by force and violence. In other words, conspiracy to teach that we were not even teaching it, that we were thinking about teaching, and that's how the trial was conducted, and I was convicted on that basis. And, of course, the Supreme Court years later threw it out exactly on that basis, you know, that you can't convict anybody for thinking. And however we were, and of course the Supreme Court made a decision after many of us had served our prison terms and so on, so that it was a difficult moment. Thousands, you know, communist and let me just say maybe even more non-communist lost their jobs because of the hysteria. And in some ways it was even more difficult for people who were not communist, who were accused of being a communist and harassed and so on. They had a little more difficult time of it, frankly, than even communists did. So it was a, let me just say, nobody has yet written the history of the McCarthy period as it really was. There are parts of it been written, but it was a horrible period in the history of the United States, and it left some very deep marks. In fact, the influences of that period are still here. I see it when I talk with people. There is a certain fear that still exists. That's a leftover of that period of history of the United States.
I assume you've read a lot of the histories and remembrances that have been written about that period. What are some of the things that you feel have been left out?
Well, I think the extent of the harassment, I think, has not been written, or the number of, for instance, of suicides that took place in that period. And I would say, again, basically non-communist, who couldn't stand the pressures and so on. And that, in my opinion, has not been documented, and at some point it should be. The number of people that lost their jobs in industry, professions, the number of teachers, professors that were fired, harassment of doctors, for instance, that I know about, and so on, and that it was tremendously expensive. Or then what it did to the trade union movement. See, one can agree or disagree about with the communists, but there's one thing I think everybody will agree, and most trade union leaders will now say it, that when the communists were kicked out of the trade union movement, and many of them were just, expelled, unions passed constitutional amendments that, kept communists out of office and so on, that weakened the whole trade union movement, and the trade union movement, in my opinion, hasn't yet made a comeback fully from that period, because it wasn't only that the communists were kicked out, but militants were kicked out who were not communists. And the trade union movement became much more conservative. It didn't fight, and therefore the living standards went down. And the trade union movement especially became weak politically. In other words, the trade union movement was beginning to be quite a political force for progress. But that again, took the trade union movement to the old position of working with the politicians. And I've often said that, you know, that the trade unions would not, permit a boss to be a head of a union, but they do permit the boss to be represent them in political circles, in Congress and state houses and so on. And so there are many of these types of influences that have not yet been probed and written about. And in a sense, it would be very important for the new generations to understand what happened in that moment in order to guarantee that it won't happen again.
During the 8 years that you spent in prison for violation of the Smith Act, and that was from like 1949 to 1957
or whatever it was, yeah.
How are you treated in prison? What do the other prisoners think of you? Were they did they consider you to be a diabolical force since you were a communist? Did you have more sympathy in jail?
Well, I think we were, if one could say that, I think amongst the more popular prisoners, and that's good and bad, because if you're popular in prison, there you accidentally get into all kinds of little hassles that you don't want to get into, but. But basically, it's a very positive thing, and I think there are many reasons why we were, popular with prisoners. I think many of the prisoners kind of looked upon us, as not being criminals, and in a sense, they wanted to gravitate towards somebody with ideals and so on, which they recognized that we have, and I think that was you know, one of the reasons. But there's many humorous things about those relationships, you know, that I often relate because they come up. For instance, you know, the story, which is absolutely true, where a bank robber told me once, he said, you know, Gus, that there's not that much difference between us and us bank robbers and you communists. And that is the difference is that we go to a bank and we want $50,000. And he says the difference is that you communists want the whole works, not only the $50,000. And there was the other one that I've often told prisoners that, in a sense, especially the bank robbers, and I don't advocate robbing banks as a way of life, but that, in a sense, they were rebelling. Many of them were from the Depression years. You know, for instance, I was in Leavenworth because I was considered, you know, the most dangerous of prisoners for some odd reason. So I was in a cell house where the most dangerous prisoners were, and it was mainly bank robbers, and a big percentage of them robbed banks during the Depression. In other words, many of them were college graduates, sons of rather well-to-do families, some of them. But the Depression brought on, you know, that idea of robbing banks. So in a sense, they were rebelling also. And so I used to tell them that, look, in that sense, you're not that much different, that I was rebellious as a youth. And if my folks and my experience didn't lead me in the direction of rebelling in the sense of organizing unions and sense of organizing demonstrations and movements of people to protest, that who knows what I would have done if I didn't move in that direction, and that if somebody would have given them a direction early in life of moving in the direction of people's movements and protest in that sense, that they most likely wouldn't have robbed banks. And so there's these kind of discussions went on all the time.
Well, when you got out from this eight-year sentence in the mid-1950s, did you... You had to make a conscious decision about how visible and vocal you were going to be politically and how you were going to make a living also. So what did you decide on for yourself?
Yeah, well, that's a big story in itself because when you get out of prison, you're on parole, and the parole lasts for a year and a half or 2 years or so on. And one of the conditions of the parole is that you have to have a job, you have to work, and not in politics, and therefore I went through an interesting experience of trying to get a job from big corporations, including corporation heads who had, you know, sounded radical and liberal and so on. But that was impossible, and so I got together and we set up a garage and a gas station because that's been one of my hobbies for life with auto mechanics. That's what I did in the Navy. I was really the head of the biggest naval repair base in the Pacific during the war. And what was interesting about that experience was that the word got around that here was an honest garage, that here were honest mechanics. And so my business just grew and grew and grew. And frankly, it just got out of hand, actually. And I was very happy to actually get rid of it at the end of the parole. And of course, I had made up my mind and that there was no reason why I should not continue in the Communist Party, and I did. And let me just tell you that when I was in prison, the revelations on the crimes of Stalin had come out, and of course, I didn't know everything, you know, because there's very few little literature in prison, especially in a place like Leavenworth, and there was a book burning when I was there, even liberal books and so on. But interesting is that the first question that I was asked at the first press conference in Cleveland when I came out was, you know, what is my thinking now that there was the revelations of Stalin's crimes and so on. So my answer, and I think it was what I really felt, was that Stalin didn't recruit me into the Communist Party. That was not the reason I joined the party, and therefore whatever Stalin did isn't going to get me out, and that I will continue because I think it's the right thing, and which I have done ever since.
I think that a lot of American communists have been accused by people who are liberals or radicals but not affiliated with the party of being blind to the Stalin purges and to the other faults of the Soviet Union and its various regimes over the past decades.
Yeah, I think there was a problem, and I think it's true when they say, and I think it was true in my case, that we did not have all of the information, and that shouldn't be too surprising. I think there are many things that go on in the world and that you do not fully know all the details, and we didn't. And let me just say that when one is for socialism, and I've always said this very honestly, that when one is for socialism, that therefore you give socialism the benefit of the doubt. In other words, you don't excuse for it. There's no excuse for the things that Stalin did in his last years. But you have to kind of put it in a context, historic context, that the Soviet Union was the first socialist country surrounded by capitalist countries who publicly threatened to destroy it and who tried it. There was the military intervention by United States and Germany and France and Italy and Great Britain and so on. Then there was the boycott, the economic boycott. And so that the Soviet Union kind of lived what one could call kind of a fortress and a fortress mentality with it of a forced industrialization in order to defend itself, and many things resulted from that. And I think what Stalin's fault and problem was in his later years was that he was not able to shift when it was not necessary for the Soviet Union anymore to have the fortress approach, because there were other socialist countries and the world had changed, the balance of forces after the Second World War had changed, and so on. And Stalin was not able to shift. He continued that same kind of an approach. And I think that's what really basically brought on the unfortunate, developments around Stalin in his last years.
What do you see the connection as being between the American Communist Party and the Soviet Union?
Well, of course, there's no organic connection with any party, and because there's no world communist organization. There hasn't been any since the Second World War, and I don't think there will be a need for it or will be such an organization again. There are fraternal relations in the sense, for instance, when a party has a congress, they send invitations, like we do, to our congress. And 2 years ago was the first time that the United States issued visas for fraternal delegates. So we had, I guess, 30 delegations from around the world.
I'd be interested in how you see a few of the Soviet Union's recent policies. And I don't want to put you in the position of being an apologist for them. And I don't know if you see yourself as being in a position of having to defend the Soviet Union or not. But the three things I'm thinking of is their treatment of dissidents within the Soviet Union, the recent invasion of Afghanistan, and the possible invasion of Poland and the suppression of Solidarity.
Yeah, well, here again, without apologizing, and very often we don't agree with everything that socialist countries do, and they have to view the world and the world around them from their viewpoint, and which I think every country does. I think the United States does that, and every country. So that I don't see anything wrong with that. Take Afghanistan. Well, I think to understand what the problem is, you have to see how they view it. And the way they view it is the following, that the United States had the most sophisticated nuclear and other military equipment, including surveillance equipment, in Iran. And that was against the Soviet Union. It was an anti-Soviet base. There's no question. Everybody agrees to that. Once we lost Iran, once the United States lost Iran and lost that base, it's obvious that the CIA was told to look for a new place, to replace Iran as the place of operation. Afghanistan was a natural. It was even closer to the Soviet Union. Secondly, there was a rebellion going on for 2 years already, a struggle, a revolution that was going on in Iran, so you had forces to work with. And so it was obvious that they took advantage of that and began to arm some of these groups, and that became a problem. And therefore, when the Afghan government, the consul, invited the Soviets in on a basis that they thought there was a threat to their independence and so on, the Soviet Union went there with two understandings. One is to defend their southern border, which I think every outfit does. And I've often said that what would the United States do if the Soviet Union went into Mexico and set up a pro-Soviet government there with the idea of nuclear weapons and so on? It's obvious that the United States would react, and so the Soviets reacted on that basis. Now, let me say there's two elements that kind of prove my point. One is the revelation now that when they couldn't establish that base in Afghanistan, they established it in China. And now there's an admission that that's what happened, that the sophisticated military equipment was moved into China I don't know about the nuclear weapons in China, but they've admitted that there is that the equipment was moved from Iran to China. And secondly, I would say that the proof of it is that the Soviet Union has said that as soon as the danger of intervention from Pakistan and Iran ends, the Soviet troops will leave. As a matter of fact, I see now where the European countries, West Germany and France and England and so on, are making some proposals for a conference that would take care of that question, a conference that would guarantee that there will be no threat of outside intervention in Afghanistan from Pakistan, and on that basis then that the Soviet troops will leave. I don't think there will be any problem. I think the Soviet troops will, the day that's accomplished, the Soviet troops will leave. So I think that's kind of proof to that.
Can you think of an instance where they ever went into a country and then left afterwards?
Well, I think, first of all, that there's a minimum of Soviet troops in any country. And, you know, let me just say that the number of countries where there are Soviet troops is 0.1% of the countries where U.S. troops are. United States has something like 480 major military bases overseas, and that you compare what the Soviets have on that, it's a very minimum amount. I'm for a policy, and I've had that for a long time, that all foreign troops should leave every country, and all the troops should remain in their own borders, and I think that would lead to a peace and so on. On Poland, just a word. Well, I'm concerned about Poland, and I've been in Poland, and I've known the Polish leaders, and including Gomulka, and personally I knew Gomulka, who was removed years ago. Gerek, I met and talked to Gerek many times, both in Poland and when he was in the United States. I had a couple hours with him and so on. Let me just say that the Polish leaders made what I call kind of a traditional mistake of leaders of socialist countries. In other words, they have good intentions. It's not that they have wrong intentions. But the good intentions are that they want to build up their industrial base, their scientific and industrial technological base, as fast as they can. To do that, you have to make sacrifices. You can't build an industrial base without sacrifices, and therefore the sacrifices must come from the people. But they try to do it so fast that the people aren't ready for those kind of sacrifices, and that lays the basis for the strikes and the rebellion. And other mistakes. The Polish leaders, they really became unrealistic in their industrialization. They tried to build industry so fast that the people weren't ready for it. They didn't have the raw materials. They couldn't pay the foreign debts because the industries weren't producing yet. And so the whole thing got out of kilter. Therefore, I've always said right from the beginning that the Polish workers had a right to strike. I think they had legitimate reasons to strike, because I think the leadership had made some real mistakes and they weren't about to correct them without that kind of pressure. Now, however, I think some anti-socialist elements, and there are anti-socialist elements, I think, in all the socialist countries who are against socialism, I think they're trying to use the rebellion and trying to use the strikes really to do away with socialism in Poland. And that, of course, creates a whole new set of problems. And in this sense, if you talk about intervention, in a sense, the banks of the United States were more responsible for the strikes than any other force, and certainly not the Soviet Union. And that is that the banks had made these loans and Poland couldn't pay, and they began to press. And it was the U.S. banks that pressed that Poland should take away the subsidies for under meat, for instance, which was a direct cause of the strikes, in order to be able to pay the banks back. And so that kind of intervention, I think, was more responsible for the problem than the Soviet. There is no country. If you put all the countries of the world together, you cannot measure even 1/10 of what the Soviet Union gives Poland. Since the first strike and a year before that, the Soviet Union has given Poland $5 billion, not rubles, but dollars, in order to help them stabilize their economy and so on. The other interesting thing about Poland is that the very thing that many of the strikers are demanding from the Polish government are things that the Soviet people have criticized Poland for a number of years already, and so that they're not on the opposite side of that question of democratization and many of these kind of demands, or a more realistic economic policy, which again the strikers are demanding.
In the country itself, in the Soviet Union, many people who are dissidents have been incarcerated and forced to stay in labor camps or forced into exile in other parts of the country. What do you think?
Yeah, there's some of that. I think there's again a tendency, which is I think is natural, to exaggerate the weaknesses. If you're against socialism, you tend to exaggerate these kind of problem. But there is some of that, and Soviet law, says, that you cannot, with false measures advocate or, against the Soviet government. And that question of being truthful is a very important question there in that law. And if they feel that there is slander, and they use the word slander, I think, in the law, against the Soviet state, that's considered a crime, and on that basis they are tried. I think in that sense they are much more lenient now about the sentences than they used to be, during Stalin's time and so on. But it's still years, some in prison, some in exile. And of course, the exile isn't what the old Siberia used to be. It really means living in cities that are not Moscow and Leningrad, and working or living ordinarily. And that's the kind of internal exile that they talk about. Obviously, the idea is not to permit them to agitate and create problems in the, in the centers and so on. Let me say that I think much of that is not necessary, and I think that's part of the old traditions yet that's left there. Generally, my impression is that as far as democracy is concerned, that socialist democracy keeps moving. I think it moves in a good direction, maybe too slow, maybe it should move faster, and I've often discussed that with many other people, but that's the direction that it's moving. The whole concept of broadening the base of government or the decision-making process, broadening that people's base is a process, and they are pushing it and fighting for it, and I think they are achieving it, and in spite of some of these other things that go with it, that fundamentally socialist democracy moves, I think, in a good direction.
I think a lot of people are confused about why you are so strongly opposed to any suppression of civil liberties or free speech in America and can justify the limitations, severe abridgment of that within the Soviet Union.
Well, let me first of all say that I don't defend that in the socialist countries. As I say, I think it has to be put into historic context. I think everything has to be. I think that's the only honest way of discussing any problem. As far as our position on civil liberties and civil rights and so on in this country is concerned, well, I think that's part of our general struggle. In other words, we are Americans, and often I'm asked, why don't I go, to a socialist country? And the answer is simple. I'm an American, and I want to make the United States as fine a place as there is. And therefore, we are part of the struggles of the people, whether it's on the economic field, wages, whether it's against racism. We are very active in that field. Electoral rights, for instance. And let me just say that there is a total exaggeration about what the electoral rights of minority parties are. We have one hell of a time getting on the ballot no matter how much we work, and we can't get on the ballot in majority of states. So it's a very limited democratic right in that sense. If you do not speak against capitalism or big business or monopoly or against racism, you have all kinds of democratic rights in the United States. But a party like the Communist Party and those of us who represent that party, our rights are restricted greatly, and that democracy is not nearly as much as we do. But we fight for as much democratic rights as possible, because it makes it easier to put our ideas over, and it's as simple as that.
One thing I'd wonder is, since it seems to me some of the things you stand for are more worker control of the workplace and of the means of production, anti-imperialism, freedom of speech, freedom of expression. And since so much of that has been abridged in certain communist countries, I'd wonder why you haven't formed a completely different party that is unaffiliated with the mistakes of other countries and is a fresh start towards the ideals that you espouse.
Well, first of all, we are not affiliated, and therefore, in our concept, there's no problem about that. I think the reason for it is, in a sense, honesty. I think we have to be honest, and I think we are, and I think we honestly deal with whatever mistakes there are, but we also honestly deal with whatever positive things there are. And for instance, there's great pressures, for instance, when I speak in colleges or things like that, there's great pressures, suggestions that I would be very popular if I would find just a little way to be anti-Soviet. And that suggestion comes almost every time I appear in colleges before I get up to speak. And my position on that is that would not be honest. I'm not going to be, give false evidence against anybody, and this includes the Soviet Union and the socialist countries, that we will deal honestly with our relationships and about socialism, both about weaknesses and mistakes, but also the positive things. And the positive things are so tremendous, and their achievements are so tremendous and great, that, yes, we speak about that, and I think that's the only way of being honest. See, I think in a country like the United States, which is the leading capitalist country, and the Soviet Union is the leading socialist country in the world, in the United States, there's no question that the big lie, the Soviet threat, the anti-Sovietism, is the main ideological pillar of U.S. capitalism. That's its main ideological that keeps hammering day in and day out. And it's based on a falsehood. It's based on the big lie. The Soviet threat is a total falsehood. There is no such a thing. The idea that the Russians are coming, they haven't come, they're not going to come, and it's a total falsehood. And let me just say, we are literally spending our country into bankruptcy on the basis of that false charge. There is no such a threat from the Soviet Union. They do not threaten the United States, and they are ready for agreements on weapons, on nuclear weapons, and everything else. We have to deal with it on that basis.
There, he's correct.
That was Gus Hall, who is the General Secretary of the American Communist Party, who was in Philadelphia a few weeks ago. This is Fresh Air on WUHY FM in Philadelphia, and it's 27 minutes to 5 o'clock. I asked historian Philip Foner to speak with us about the American Communist Party, their influence on the American labor movement and American politics, and to also compare the American Communist Party with communism as it's practiced in other countries like the Soviet Union and Cuba, and with the principles of Eurocommunism. Philip Foner is the author of over 80 books on labor history, the black American history, and the history of socialism. He's held seminars in Poland for the members of Solidarity. He's taught in the German Democratic Republic and the Soviet Union, Hungary, Czechoslovakia. He's leaving for China next week for Nankai and Peking universities, where he will be teaching courses on labor history. From there, he makes a return trip to Cuba to teach courses on labor and the history of blacks in America. He's joined us in the past on Fresh Air to talk about labor history and the economic and labor history of blacks in Philadelphia. You may have also heard him on All Things Considered, providing historical background on labor issues. We're not going to be talking specifically about the comments that he agreed and disagreed with that Gus Hall has made, but we're going to be talking more broadly about different countries who have communist parties within them. Philip Foner, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
And do you think the Communist Party is much of a force in America now, the American Communist Party?
It's a question of how you define a force. It certainly is not as big a force as it was during the period of the 1930s or even during World War II. After all, history changes. The man who spoke here was only one of a number of communists who went to jail. And to be a communist in the period of the McCarthy era was to risk one's livelihood and one's ability to stay out of jail. Obviously, it was not an attractive type of organization to belong to. This is apart from the fact of the effect of the Stalin revelations and other things. So it would not be surprising to find that the Communist Party is not as viable a movement as it once was. But you cannot judge the influence of the Communist Party solely by membership or votes in presidential campaigns. You have to ask, what does it stand for? And does it do its ideas have an influence in the body politic or in the labor movement or in society? And I think in some ways it still does have an important important influence. I would myself feel that of all the groups on the left, which is not a very strong movement anyway in the United States today, the Communist Party is still the most influential and most important.
I've always had the impression, though, that a lot of the left, and granted the left is pretty splintered, is pretty alienated from the Communist Party.
It's not new. I mean, there were splits in the Communist Party even at its height. And there are parts of the left which are, of course, alienated from the Communist Party. There are those, for example, Gus Horn mentioned that when he goes to a college, they tell him maybe it would be best to criticize the Soviet Union. Well, there are those who feel that if they can convince the American people that they're critical of the Soviet Union, that that's going to give them the opportunity to build a viable left. And they have tried. They've even put out newspapers. And frankly, that doesn't do the trick. That doesn't do the trick. It's your program is what has to count. And don't forget, we have to remember this. I don't care whether it's the Communist Party or the Socialist Workers' Party or this group or that group. The media in the United States, which is the means of getting to the attention of the American people and their thinking, is dominated more completely in this country than in any other capitalist country by the powerful monopoly forces. And it's getting more so. Every day you get reports of how newspapers are being pushed out of existence. The Washington area now has only one paper. I don't want to predict for Philadelphia. The New York Daily News gave up there. Well, what does it mean? It means that at one time, in the days of Socialist Party, for example, there were hundreds of radical papers in the country, dailies, weeklies. It didn't take very much to put out a paper. So that there was an alternative point of view which the people could listen to, read. And radio wasn't in existence. Television wasn't in existence. So you had an opportunity to compare the viewpoint of the established press, the commercial press, with the viewpoint of the radical press or the liberal press, more liberal press. That's very difficult today. How do you get the point of view across to the people when it's all slanted in one direction, practically? And then there's radio. Of course, I'm here to contradict that, but I guarantee you that much as your program is loved, you still don't have the audience of CBS or other nationwide programs. And there's television. Well, how does Gus Hall, running on the Communist Party ticket, able to reach people when to get on a program requires spending hundreds of thousands of dollars? You know what the Republican Party and Democratic Party spent. So you don't need to deprive these minority parties of the democratic right to be on the ballot, although they do that anyway. All you have to do is to close the media to reach the people. So all they get is one point of view.
You said that you think that the party still has some influence in labor.
Yes.
Certainly not as strong as it was. What was the period when there was a strong influence that the party had? And what effects did that have on the labor movement?
Well, let's go backwards. First of all, Gus Hall made a statement with which I agree. He said that the McCarthy witch hunts affected the American labor movement. I agree with that. I've written on that. What happened? In the period of 1948 to 1951, some 11 unions of the CIO, national unions, international unions, were eliminated from the CIO. They were expelled from the CIO. Now, they were not expelled because they failed to do things in the interest of their membership. And the truth is, they were the most advanced in the fight for the conditions of their membership in terms of wages, reduction of hours. But not only that, they were in the vanguard in the fight against racism in the labor movement, a long fight which is still being continued in the labor movement. They fought sexism. They weren't perfect. It's very difficult to find perfection in the labor movement on these things, but they were the vanguard. These 11 unions, United Electrical Workers, the Fur and Leather Workers Union, the Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers, the great the International Longshoremen and Warehousemen's Union, the Food, Tobacco, Agriculture, and Allied Workers, United Public Workers, they were the vanguard of the American labor movement, the militant unions that led the way. They were gotten rid of because of the Cold War. Because the rest of the CIO, under the leadership of Murray and Carey and Reuther of the great Reuther of the UAW, became an agent of American Cold War ideology against the Soviet Union. And they didn't like the fact that these unions took an attitude towards the Marshall Plan which differed from theirs, supported Henry Wallace in 1948. Now, that's a right which unions have. They have a right to support the presidential candidate that they want to support. For this, however, they were kicked out of the AFL, out of the CIO. So that when the AFL and CIO merged in 1955, the CIO was not what it had been at one time. It had eliminated the most militant forces from the CIO. What was the result of this? Those who remained, two results were. First, those who remained were the very people who had done the expulsion. And by the way, gave McCarthy the go-ahead signal, because it was the CIO which was ahead of McCarthy. McCarthy moved against the unions and others in 1950-51, and the CIO started in 1948-49. They were the vanguard of the witch hunters. The result was that what remained was the elements who were red baiters out to fight anyone who stood for principles associated with the Communist Party or influenced by the Communist Party. Well, what principles? Equalitarianism of black and white. Well, if you stood for equal rights of black and white, you were a communist. So you kept your mouth shut in order not to get kicked out of the job or the union. Fight against sexism, you're a communism. Fight on the question of militant struggle, fight for an independent political action for labor, all these things were associated with communism. And therefore, the unions tended to shy away from these things and became more and more associated with the Cold War activity. Well, the AFL-CIO then was not what the CIO had once been. It became more and more conservative. And today, many labor leaders who were involved in that at that time acknowledge that it was a great mistake to have done that, that the labor movement suffered very severely by getting rid of the radicals, the communists, and those who sympathized with them. Because the CIO was built by an alliance of men like John L. Lewis and others, Philip Murray and Sidney Hillman and others, with the communists, William Z. Foster, and the communists were the people who did much of the hard organizing work. When nobody else wanted to go into these open shop places to organize the auto workers and the rubber workers and the steel workers and the textile workers and the maritime workers. I know I taught for the CIO in 1936, 37, 38, 38, 39, so on. I knew what was going on. I saw what the communists were doing. They were devoting themselves to organizing, and they were organizing black and white together. And they had a viability because workers trusted them. They had known from experience of the Depression period that communists were in the vanguard of the fight for the unemployed. So when Gus Hall says that the labor movement suffered by this, he's correct. Labor history proves it. Oh, that doesn't mean that everybody agrees with me, but they have to prove that I'm wrong.
Yes. You've taught in a number of communist countries,
yes,
including Cuba, the Soviet Union. How do you think other communist countries view the American Communist Party?
Well, they view the American Communist Party as conducting a tough fight against incredible odds in the face of a country which is the strongest capitalist, imperialist country in the world, out to fight communism and radicalism everywhere. So in such a country, it's not surprising that a party that doesn't have its own press and doesn't have its own straw, it has its own press, but how can it get out to the masses of people with in the millions? It's very difficult. So they're not surprised that the Communist Party is not a very big party.
How monolithic do you think communism is, since I think a lot of people include a lot of different countries as being identical in philosophy because they're communist?
Well, in one sense, they are. That is, if you are a communist, you are supposed to adhere, believe in, you're convinced in the ideology of Marx and Engels and Lenin. That is Marxism-Leninism. Originally, socialism was the ideas of Marx and Engels. A communism, which was considered to be the next stage in the development of socialism, were the ideas of Marx and Engels and the ideas of Lenin, who was the leader of the first communist revolution, the Bolshevik revolution in what became the Soviet Union, and a prolific writer and ideological leader of movements was added to that. And so communist countries generally tend to be influenced by Marxism-Leninism in their evaluation of world issues and other things. But the concept that a communism or communist societies are monolithic, all the same, identical, that was one of the weaknesses of the American evaluation of the world after the Second World War. The failure of even the Dulleses and the Eisenhowers and the others to note that there were differences. For example, Titoism in Yugoslavia was a difference, showing that there was no real monolithic communist movement. Then Maoism that developed in the conflict between... I don't want to get into an issue of whether who was correct. I'm simply saying the idea that communism was monolithic and they made it possible for our country to make a great many mistakes. For example, when we rejected the effort of the People's Republic of China to have relations with the United States, we fought not to allow them to be represented in the United Nations. How ridiculous that Taiwan would be the representative of all the hundreds of millions of people of China. We did that on the ground that China was a puppet of the Soviet Union, when everything was indicating that it was no, that this was an absurd position, you see. Or when we rejected the effort of Ho Chi Minh to have good relations with the United States after he had built up a country in which he adopted the American Declaration of Independence for the constitution of Vietnam of that time, we did it on the ground that he was a puppet of the Soviet Union. Well, there are differences. There are similarities and there are differences, and you have to understand that in order to operate in a viable sense. If you're going to go back today to the monolithic concept of all countries, you're going to fall into the same trap that we did before.
Could you describe Eurocommunism and the similarities and differences that you see it having with...
Well, Eurocommunism was a movement that arose, and I'm sure you know as much about it as many people do, a few years ago as part of a feeling in especially Europe, European countries, Spain, where it Carrillo of the Spanish Communist Party was the ideological father of it, and it began to influence Italy and for a while France and other countries, the feeling that communism, in order to become more viable, in Europe would have to appeal to the people by convincing them that it did not adhere to all the ideas of Marxism-Leninism, dictatorship of the proletariat, and would be critical of things in the Soviet Union that they felt that people identified communists as simply puppets of the Soviet Union. And therefore, this emerged. This is, of course, a very brief thing. And it ran into a lot of difficulty. First of all, the reactionaries and the conservatives viewed Eurocommunism as a trick to say, oh, yes, they are going to try to win over people by saying they're anti the principles of the Soviet Union. But once they go and get into power, they'll do exactly the same. You can't trust them. So they didn't always win their position. And secondly, in order to make it clear that they differentiated themselves from the Soviet Union, they had to become more and more anti-Soviet because people would say, oh-ho, you see, Soviet Union did this. Now, where do you stand on that? And so some Eurocommunists developed the, we have them in this country too, developed a sort of, you might say, like in physics, a force and reaction to it. The moment the Soviet Union did something, they had to criticize it, no matter what it did, in order to say, you see, we're anti-Soviet, and therefore we're not to be confused. Well, once you go down that road, you end up by joining the Cold Warriors, and you become you join the group that's function is primarily to attack the Soviet Union. So I've never been over-impressed with Eurocommunism.
You recently spent some time in Poland, and there you lectured some of the held seminars for some of the members of Solidarity. What do you think of, given in America you were talking about the radical part that the American Communist Party played in the labor movement, in Poland now we see the Soviet Union trying to suppress Solidarity, the Polish labor union, and there seems to be an enormous irony in that.
Well, I would say the irony is in the way you put it. First of all, Solidarity is still here. For a giant country like the Soviet Union to try to suppress it, I would say it's not been very successful. The truth is that the Soviet Union is critical of Solidarity, but it has not, and it has tried to call attention to the Polish Communist Party leadership about things in Solidarity with which they feel, which they disagree, and which Gus Hall pointed to, namely what they feel will be a movement to not simply rectify the grievances of workers, but to turn against the whole society and socialism. From their standpoint, that is a very dangerous thing. But they have not intervened in the sense of sending troops in. That has not happened, and they've given their opinion. And I think that the situation is a very touchy one. I think what has happened in Poland is that forces are at work that will seek to undermine the government, and then the other elements in Poland will not support that, and the government will win some support and then lose some support. It's a very difficult thing to predict exactly which way it's going to turn out. But I feel, as Gus Hall pointed out, that there were mistakes made, and what has happened had to happen, and the government of Poland is trying to work in existing, bring about changes which will solve some of their problems. They have enormous problems. We'll take a whole session just. But incidentally, I want to make one point, if we have a few minutes, just this, and namely that the idea of intervention in the sense of criticism or giving suggestions by other socialist countries must be viewed from a standpoint of historical evidence. Gus Hall mentioned that there is no international today. That's true. The CI, or the Communist International, was dissolved in World War II. Now, the Communist International, or the Third International, the started with the Soviet Union. And many historians feel that the American Communist Party was simply a puppet doing the bidding of the CI. And yet, when you look at it, there are things which were advised by the leaders of the Soviet Union, of the CI, that benefited not only the American Communist Party, but the whole struggle for a better America. And I want to give you just briefly two examples. Lenin, who was the leader of the Soviet Union, was critical of the American communists on two points, both of which he had some very valid points to criticize. One was that the American communists, influenced by a long tradition in the American radical movement and labor, tended to want to have nothing to do with the existing unions, particularly to work within the existing unions, like the American Federation of Labor. On the ground, it was all one reactionary group. As a result, they went and set up separate unions. And this was true in Daniel DeLeon. Even the IWW did that. When William Z. Foster, who was 100th anniversary is being celebrated this year, suggested that the job of the radicals was to work inside the existing unions and convince the workers there on a progressive trade union policy, his views were scorned by most radicals. They felt it was a sellout. But Lenin published a pamphlet in 1920 called Left-Wing Communism and Infantile Disorder, which was translated into English, in which a very important section was called, Is It Right? Should Revolutionaries Work in Reactionary Trade Unions? And he said, yes. It is the duty of revolutionaries to work inside reactionary trade unions and convince the members of these unions to convince them on a correct trade union policy, such as industrial unionism versus craft unionism, instead of craft unionism. And one of the reasons we finally had the triumph of industrial unionism was that the radicals and the communists were doing exactly that. So that's one example. And the other example was that Lenin criticized them by saying that you've got to deal with the black workers as the main, most exploited element in American seed. They are not just ordinary workers, like the socialists used to say, just like everybody else. And when socialism comes, everybody's problem will be solved. He said, they are especially oppressed, and you must pay special attention to them. That was a very important contribution. So this is a two-way street. Not only, you can also get benefits from countries of socialism in other areas.
We only have about a minute or less remaining, but and this is an unfair question to ask in that time. I'll ask it anyways. What do you think the future, if you care to speculate, will be for the American Communist Party?
What is the future for the American people? And I think that if there remains a world that isn't blown to bits by the policy that is risking a thermonuclear war, I'm not too worried of radicalism or the left. In the end, I think Reaganomics will prove to be wrong, that it will not solve the problem, and that the Democratic Party is proving that it can't solve the problems either. And I think there will be a leftward surge in the American scene. I think the Great Solidarity Day meeting rally of September 19th is an indication of a fight back, and I think the Communist Party will play a part in that, an important part.
I think so.
Okay.
Okay. Philip Foner, thanks for coming back to Fresh Air. And Philip Foner is going to be back with us next Tuesday at 4 o'clock. And we're going to be talking about some of the labor precedents that that would be interesting to keep in mind in understanding the current labor movement. And we'll be talking about his evaluation of the PATCO strike and the government's handling of it. We'll also be opening up the telephones for your questions and comments. So that's next Tuesday between 4 and 5 o'clock here on Fresh Air. Let me just tell you what's happening tomorrow on Fresh Air. At 2 o'clock, we'll be rebroadcasting my interview with Joe Klein, the author of the biography of Woody Guthrie called Woody Guthrie, A Life. And then at 3:30, Bill Van Wert will be with us to review the new film Stevie, which stars Glenda Jackson. Then between 4 and 5 o'clock, we'll be talking about America's drug policy. And with me will be Dr. Peter Bourne, who developed the Carter administration policies to fight drug traffic, and Dr. David Feingold, who has spent much time in Thailand, Burma, and Laos studying heroin production and distribution. And we'll be discussing the marketing and the politics of international drug traffic. This will be a return visit for David Feingold. So that's tomorrow afternoon between 4 and 5 o'clock. And I hope you can join us then. Contributing to this afternoon's Fresh Air was Bob Carlin and Francis Davis. Technical director was Stephen Waterman. The production assistant for Fresh Air is Maeve McGoran. The associate producer is Danny Miller. My name's Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great evening. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. This is Noah Adams.
And I'm Sanford Unger with All Things Considered.
A young soldier some years ago told me he was taking an army indoctrination course in which they used the Weavers in an army manual. It said that the Weavers had decided to make some hit records in order to give the money to the Communist Party. I could never get a copy of that. I also would love to have known how you go about making hit records at will to give the money to anybody.
Lee Hayes. He sang with the folk music group known as the Weavers. Lee Hayes died yesterday in Tarrytown, New York. Tonight in All Things Considered, the 50s and folk